McKim, Mead, and White are perhaps the best-known American architects of the Gilded Age. Among their iconic structures are the Washington Square Arch, the original Madison Square Garden, and the Morgan Library. What's more, their lives away from the drafting table were nearly as dramatic as the buildings that they produced. Now, Mosette Broderick has written an account of it all called Triumvirate, McKim, Mead, and White. It's published by Knopf. I'm very pleased that it brings her to our show today. Hello.
Thank you very much.
So how do they rank in comparison with some of the other celebrated American architects like Louis Sullivan, Frank Lloyd Wright, Raymond Hood, more recently Frank Gehry?
All wonderful architects and all a little bit different. Compared to Frank Lloyd Wright, who was an innovative Midwesterner, very eager to do different things and do things for a different audience, McKim, Mead, and White saw themselves as transforming the nation, and they saw buildings as the vehicle for it. To them, their work was going to transform America into part of the old world. They were going to move us into a par with European countries at the time. In terms of ingenuity and creativity, perhaps Louis Sullivan was unique in his somewhat abstracted, wonderful design forms. Raymond Hood was a great mass maker of building complexes. He could make the mass look wonderfully well.
And both of them are connected to the history of modern modernist architecture.
That's right.
When I think McKim, Mead, and White, I do not think modernism.
No, you are correct. I guess when they started, they were very young men in the middle of the 19th century, and the middle of the 19th century is a time when architecture was still looking for precedence abroad. So what they were doing was following the latest trends in England, maybe the kind of buildings that people were building in the Norman resorts on the north coast of France. And later on, they will end up doing buildings that are based on Italian palazzo and European form, something that they don't initially do. It happens to them. And then they become the purveyors of it. So what they do is reinterpret older buildings with closets. Mm-hmm. That's the difference. Everything inside is modern and up to everything is modern and up to date in Kansas City.
But it isn't like a lot of the other architecture in New York at the time, which seemed to be influenced by French architecture, Versailles, and there were all those mansard roofs. I'm not sure whether McKim, Mead, and White did any mansard.
They sure did. When they started out in their first 10 years, when they didn't have jobs, and oddly enough, these are three men who had absolutely no signs of greatness on their own. It's the synthesis of the men when they came together that makes them famous. But they did indeed. McKim's work in the 1870s, along with Mead, they met and worked together in a sort of informal arrangement for about 6 years. Their main job was putting mansards on existing brownstones. There's one left. It's in semi-bad shape. But if you go to 64, I think it is, East 34th Street, just west of Park Avenue on the south side of the street, you can see what they did. They did put mansards. That made those brownstones more up to date.
How did they come to work together?
All coincidence. It all happened through the great, speaking of great American architects, and not in the discussion we just had, there was a man called Henry Hobson Richardson, who I know you know, who to me was the greatest architect of the 19th century in America, a remarkable man. And they all had varying dealings with Richardson. McKim went to work for him as a paid draftsman just when he came back from Paris from a rather uninspired stint at the École des Beaux-Arts, where he was one of the first Americans to participate in that French educational system that will end up having 725 Americans go, many of whom came to McKim, Mead, and White later. But he worked for Richardson, and then he was replaced by an office boy who joined the firm just when McKim came there, but with no education, who hadn't finished high school, whose father was not willing to do anything for his young son's education at all and sent him to work for Richardson, and that was Stafford White. But Stafford White had remarkable abilities to draw, which McKim didn't have and which Richardson didn't have, and to do interiors. So White was able to gain Richardson's confidence, and within 2 years, when McKim left to go on his own, White took over his place.
Well, you've named your book Triumvirate, which would suggest that the three men contributed equally to the firm's work.
Sort
but
of.
If you were to speak to most people who know a little bit about architecture, they would all say Stafford White
and
then
White.
Those other guys.
Yeah, I think people would because of the notoriety. And, you know,
Well, he also designed some pretty great buildings. And Eve, right now, I think if you go into any bookstore that has a lot of architecture books, you'll see a whole bunch of Stanford White books, but you won't see too many McKim books.
That's correct. Absolutely. Sam White, the great-grandson of Stanford White, who is himself a wonderful architect, has produced a lovely series of beautiful books on Stanford White's buildings. McKim was not probably a great architect. The mere choice that he goes to architecture training surprises everybody because he showed no interest or aptitude as a young man. And when he came back, he did stick French roofs on existing buildings and do a little work. But he, by the middle of his career, had already become kind of the dean of American architecture. And he was much more interested in establishing a proper training program for American architects, which becomes the American Academy in Rome. That's what he devoted himself. That was his life. His life was education, providing architectural training for kids, giving talented people, even if they weren't in school, a break. So he becomes dean of the profession more than architect.
And they wind up designing the American Academy in
Part
Rome.
Part of it, yep. Yep.
A building that still exists.
Yes, it does.
And looks slightly, I don't know if it looks out of place, but it does have this wonderful kind of stateliness, and like
yes.
so many of the buildings.
Yes.
You mentioned that they thought about creating some kind of a revolution here, but we're talking about a revolution always in the grand scale.
And
they were not producing brownstone houses for poor people in Brooklyn and the Bronx.
Although oddly enough, Stanford White does do some industrial housing for companies. For Edward Dean Adams, who had been a client in the seminal work the firm produced, which McKim and White had nothing to do with, the Villard houses.
Which are beautiful.
Which were done by the behind-the-scenes genius, in my opinion, of the first decade of McKim and White's work, a man called Joseph M. Wells, who dies young.
He could have been the fourth member of the group.
He was, in fact, asked to be. And there was some sort of squabble between Wells and White, and Wells walked out, and McKim came in and said, "What's wrong?" And I said, "Oh, I can't stay. I must have said something like, I'm tired of doing all the work for you guys, getting no money, getting no recognition." And McKim said, "We should make him a partner." And White balks, and this must have been some sort of fracas. And then McKim writes him a letter, and White agrees. And he says, "Yes, we have been unfair." And they go in and they offer Wells a partnership, which would have made it McKim, Mead, White, and Wells about 1890. And just at this moment, Wells, who's young, who's overworking, who probably has just contracted pneumonia, says to them, he was angry with White for probably personal reasons. And he said, "I wouldn't put my name on so much damned bad work." And I think this was just a momentary tantrum. I think he expected the offer to resume, but unfortunately, the pneumonia got him. And he promptly died, quickly died thereafter. So he might have really been McKim, Mead, White, and Wells.
My guest is Mosette Broderick, the director of the Urban Design and Architecture Studies Program and the Historical and Sustainable Architecture MA Program at New York University. She's written a book called Triumvirate, McKim, Mead, and White, Art, Architecture, Scandal, and Class in America's Gilded Age. It is published by Knopf. This is WNYC, wnyc.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The film is often linked with the Gilded Age
yes.
in America. A period called the American Renaissance.
Yes.
Now, what period are we talking about?
Well, all of this happens very quickly. There are a series of stylistic changes. When you look at early McKim and early White work, which exists in the book, you can see that they were doing a house in the country, a wooden house in the country. That's how they started, putting roofs on brownstones. And then they become more important, and they see themselves as stylistic and taste makers.
Influenced by the French Beaux-Arts style?
Partially influenced by the French Beaux-Arts style, but warped into the Italian Renaissance by Joseph M. Wells, who did these huge drawings, which are now at the Century Club, and they're very beautiful. Perhaps the first really professional drawings done by an American in America, having never been abroad, done by Wells, of Italian palaces. And so they left the Villard houses, which was a building for McKim's own once brother-in-law. And they went for McKim and White went away, and Wells did the buildings. And then the buildings made them famous. In fact, the head of the committee to build the Boston Public Library comes down and says, "Because of your building, Mr. McKim, we want you to do it." And McKim's going, sure, okay, right. He had nothing to do with it. But then he embraces the Renaissance, and even if he was personally perhaps more home at home in Georgia, in England of the Edwardian age, personally, it was Italian buildings that he built.
Now, that Villard House, one of the most beautiful buildings, it
has
changed hands a number of times. Yes. It was, for a long time, it was part of the, connected to the Catholic Church.
Sure was.
Because St. Patrick's is across the street. Random House had its offices there.
That's right.
Municipal Arts Society.
Sure did.
And then a bunch of, Le Cirque had a restaurant there. Now it is
interior.
A place called Gilt. But the oddest thing is that when it almost was lost, the way it was saved was by a decision to cut off the back wall.
Correct. The brownstone on the inner part of the courtyard, the two houses in the middle, it was originally five houses with a sixth one right behind. So it was originally for six different families. Even if it looked as big and single-family as the Villard House, as the Vanderbilt House.
It was a fancy tenement house?
No, it was a fancy apartment. Brownstone complex, mm-hmm. I guess we should say. Six different families. The Fahnestock family owned three of the houses on the north wing. And in between were two cronies of Villard. Villard had the south wing, and two of his cronies were in the middle. And though the interior of one of his cronies' houses was given to the Brooklyn Museum, it has never been displayed, but they own it. And they cut out those two middle houses totally. They tore down the sixth house that was a Fahnestock house that was Cap Cities, if anybody remembers it. Capital Cities had their headquarters in it for many, many years. And all that's standing from the middle houses is the brownstone blocks set on the steel frame of the modern hotel building.
But the exterior is just so gorgeous.
It's so gorgeous.
No, the amazing thing is that we do consider them among the greatest architects in our history.
Yes,
and yet,
I think they are.
So many of their buildings have been destroyed.
Correct. Far too many. McKim saw it happening in his own day. He, the wonderful Knickerbocker.
That's because he lived longer than everybody else.
No, he lived short. Meade is the one who lived. No, McKim did not recover from the murder of Stanford White. He was never the same and lived only 3 years after that. But he did see his work of the 1870s and 80s going down in his own lifetime. And he was around when they took the moat. You know, all buildings had an areaway or a moat. And he lived long enough to see the University Club lose its moat to the widening of Fifth Avenue and was none too happy. So a lot went down in their own day, but a lot went down. Buildings that were built forever for the robber barons of the Gilded Age go down after the war to become tract developments.
And the one that most people mourn is Penn Station.
Penn Station, yes. That was a late McKim building, although McKim was already so very ill when the building got underway that it was heavily done. And this will be the next stage of the McKim Eaton White story. They bring in very talented young men, and they bring in a man called William Sims Richardson, who did most of Penn Station. It was under McKim's aegis, but it's done by another man.
Is it ironic that the building that has been proposed for a new Penn Station is a McKim Mead
and
White
building?
Isn't that
funny? Yes.
Done the James again. Frawley Post Office.
That's correct. That was again done after McKim was very much on the ground by then. The book does talk about the McKim Mead and White buildings done when the partners, when the triumvirate were alive. After their death, Penn Station was finished off by Richardson. The municipal building was built. It was a building that was built out of a rejected Grand Central Station idea that Stanford White, who wanted to build a skyscraper, never got to do it. So it's his rejected Grand Central Station, but it was done after he was dead. And the post office was done by William Mitchell Kendall, who was who was really the first partner in the firm after White's death.
Now, WNYC had its offices and studios in the municipal building from 1928 until just a couple of years ago.
Beautiful.
And I both loved the building and hated the building because it was beautiful to look at.
Yep.
And those incredible columns in the front, it's right next to the Brooklyn Bridge across from City Hall. On the other hand, it was just one of the most awful buildings to work in. I don't know whether we can blame McKim, Mead & White or the fact that the city just neglected it.
It was a terrible construction story, as you probably know. The schist cliff of Manhattan goes off on the south side of the building. So when they started building the building, they got permission. In fact, you know, that's the building that saved McKim Eaton White as a business. When your principal is murdered in
Technicolor. Stanford White had been killed a few years before.
1906. So it's just a year before. And what happens is the mother of Stanford White's assassin, this horrible Mom Thaw, I call her, she had plays written about how this terrible predatory architect did terrible things to young women. So the firm was really at death's door. And it was only then when they got the job for the municipal building, which was a rejected version of the Grand Central Station Central Tower. It was the reason that they didn't get Grand Central Station. It was too big. When that happened, thank you, I'm sorry. When that happened, then that saved McKimmie & White. It proved that the government, that New York City would back them. But then they couldn't build it because there was such a structural problem with the cliff giving way that it took 7 years to get the engineering right. And by that point, it's 1914, we're going towards the war, and the interior floor plates of the building are banal.
It's ironic that it is directly across the City Hall Park from one of the great early skyscrapers, the Woolworth Building.
Yeah.
I don't know whether they felt like they were in competition because they weren't building skyscrapers, and Cass Gilbert built that incredibly beautiful building.
It actually was going on at exactly the same time. And ironically, in the early days of skyscrapers in New York, George B. Post's seminal Western Union building had been just about where the Woolworth Building is, and Richard Morris Hunt's 1873 New York Tribune building was across the park, too. In this case, Cass Gilbert and Woolworth had begun to talk that early, but the municipal building was underway. And what it really, to me, the municipal building is City Hall, which was a palace in early 19th century New York. And the municipal building is sort of a version of the same building with its curved arms and its golden statue atop it with a cupola showing civic splendor. But for the 21st century city, an office building, because the city's getting big and it's not a palace anymore. It's an office building for a big capital of much of America.
You have talked about the murder of Sanford White. We'll take a little break. When we come back, we'll get into that in a bit more detail. My guest is Mosette Broderick, who is the director of the Urban Design and Architecture Studies Program and the Historical and Sustainable Architecture MA Program at New York University. Her book, Triumvirate, McKim, Mead, and White, Art, Architecture, Scandal, and Class in America's Gilded Age, published by Knopf. Stay with us. We're back with Mosette Broderick. Her book, Triumvirate, McKim, Mead, and White, Art, Architecture, Scandal, and Class in America's Gilded Age, published by Knopf. Let's talk about scandal a bit. They got the commission for, was it the first Madison Square Garden or the second?
No, second. It was rebuilding of the old car barns that was the first matter. But they got the commission for what was the classic, the one we think of when we think of Madison Square Gardens.
Would it have remained suitable for the sports events that have taken place in the subsequent Madison Square Gardens?
Probably would have been better, although it was financially a disaster. It was built to house high and low end sports, pugilism, dog shows, horse shows, and things where people ate hot dogs versus things where people went and drank champagne. So it was an economic disaster in all the years. How long did it live? It lived about 30 years. It was torn down by Cass Gilbert, by one of Stanford White's old students, so to speak. He tore it down in 1925 for the Met for New York Life, which is there today. But I think it would have been a much more beautiful building, and I think it would have functioned very nicely. It even had a covered arcade, so you could walk out and walk around without getting wet and wait for any kind of vehicular transit to leave the shows.
Its replacements have all been rather undistinguished buildings.
Yep.
But it was knocked down simply because it wasn't a moneymaker?
The corporation, which was the investment tool of many well-to-do people from J.P. Morgan to Stanford White, everybody but Carnegie. Carnegie got out, decided the music wasn't going to be good enough, and went up and got his hall. But it was a stock company, and it did very badly financially, and everybody lost money. And eventually, it gets the valuable land is more important.
Well, how important was what happened, the murder of Stanford White by Harry Kendall Thaw on the roof garden of the building. Was that one of the reasons people suddenly started? I would think that it would have brought people to the building.
If anything, the building, the problem was the events were sporadic. They were, the horse show goes for 10 days and it's a great deal of traffic in the building. They had big things, fairs, big things to raise money. They had lots of events in it, but it was dark a lot of the time also. In the summer, there was a roof garden with a wonderful steel-framed roof that could quietly retract in 15 minutes, opening the people enjoying a repast on the roof to the night air. That was really wonderful. And in the summer, they would have vaudeville and entertainments, including the famous reviews of the Floradora Girls and other such light musical entertainment.
And it was during one of those performances, in fact, during...
That's right.
The suggestive chorus song, I Could Love a Million Girls.
Yes, that's right.
At the premiere performance of the musical review, Mamselle Champagne.
That's right.
That Stanford White was killed.
Correct.
Now, he had a reputation as a ladies' man. And and this was the result of an affair he'd had with an underage model named Evelyn Nesbit.
Evelyn Nesbit.
He was not a nice guy, it seems.
I wouldn't say that. The culture of that time period was rather totally involved in girls who came from the country looking, I would say, I was initially of that same opinion, but I think a lot of the young women who came and met with these men knew exactly what they were doing, and I think they wanted to be the younger second wife. I think many of these people came with the idea that they would have a wonderful life because they were beautiful, they would attract a middle-aged man away from his family, and that they would be then...
That doesn't happen anymore, Mazen.
Probably not. I've never seen it. 50, 20s club? No. And Evelyn...
She would have been a trophy wife,
but White was having nothing to do with it. But he was very responsible. He took care of her mother. He took care of her brother. He took care of her teeth. He provided, even when she got into some sort of jam with other men, he paid the money. Part of the reason Stanford White died hugely in debt, owing in the neighborhood of $750,000 $1,906. He was massively in debt. And part of the reason was he took care of people. He did love them, but he didn't leave them. His buddies did, the other men of that era. And Evelyn Nesbit had taken up with one of their own circle, James Garland, before White. So he wasn't such a bad guy.
As it turned out, White probably wouldn't have lived much longer
That's right. He had degenerative kidney disease. And he probably had about 6 months to live.
How did the personal lives of McKim and Mead stack up against White's?
Well, we wish we knew. McKim was a son of abolitionist parents. Very, very high-minded. McKim was high-minded. He had no luck at all with women. He married first a very beautiful girl who seemed to be capable of bringing clients to him just before the market went down in 1873. And she then turned out to be not at all nice, left him, accused him of breaking up the marriage, which probably he didn't do, and kept her daughter, their daughter, from seeing her father until the daughter broke down at about age 20 and demanded to see her father. Her mother never let her see her own family that she grew up with again. And then McKim marries again, and to a very high-minded Boston woman, again an ideal marriage for McKim, and she dies in childbirth a year and a half later. Both she and the child die. So rather like Teddy Roosevelt, you know that story about Teddy Roosevelt, and in the New York Row House on 35th Street. So McKim's personal life was one of erudite parties where he would try to get a college degree for a client he was working with, while White's parties were lots of girls. You know, a redhead would come out and serve you red wine, and a blonde would serve you the white wine. They were very different, but they both used parties. But McKim's personal life was dour. Mead, we know nothing about. He didn't socialize. He didn't go to parties. He married out of sync. He married at a Hungarian woman who provided him, one would think, with nothing. She had no particular clients to bring to the firm. She didn't provide any enrichment for the firm. He stayed married to her for his whole life. He probably had another life on the side. When you take a look, and in the book there's a picture of the wonderful art critic of the early 20th century who'd been an office boy in McKim, Mead & White's office, a man called Royal Cortizos, who they called Robert. But when you take a look at Robert and Mead joking together in front of a camera, there may have been another story to Mead's life, but whatever it is, he didn't party, he didn't buy things, he didn't get in trouble, and we can't flesh him out. He left behind no records, except he's buried on top of his brother in Florence.
Your subtitle is Art, Architecture, Scandal, and Class.
Right.
Now, class is really important here, isn't it? They designed a lot of the clubs in New York for the rich.
Of course, I'm sorry.
What role did those clubs play in the social and business life of the city? And were McKim, Mead, and White members of
the
clubs?
Yes, McKim was the first club member. Very quickly in the 1870s, he becomes a member of the University Club. And gradually through the next 30 years when they're designing the clubs. They all belong to all the clubs. In fact, when Stanford, as opposed to England, where you identified by one club, in America, you kind of went to everyone. And if you get into every club, you were clubbable, therefore a good person. And Stanford White seems to have belonged to about 50 clubs at his death. The clubs are where you met people who gave you jobs. And if you look at the committees in every one of the club building stories, they're all McKibben and White clients. So it's everybody getting together at dinner, after dinner, and giving each other jobs. That's what it was all about.
So there was the Century Club, there was
Metropolitan Club,
the University Club.
The University Club. There were many more. There was the Players Club, which was redone from the house of Edwin Booth.
And most of them still survive.
Yes. The clubs amazingly survive. It's the mansions that are gone more than anything else, and the banks and smaller business buildings that are gone.
But many of the banks do survive, only they've been converted into restaurant spaces.
Some of the big ones, yeah. I'm thinking of the Knickerbocker Savings Bank and those wonderful once on the side of the 34th Street and 5th, there was a big bank, and there was another one on 42nd Street.
But I have problems understanding how they would be doing all of these big projects. They did the Brooklyn Museum.
Yes,
they did the Washington Square Arch.
Yep.
And they did these clubs for the wealthy. What were they doing designing these beautiful bank buildings, which looked to some degree like cathedrals?
They did. Everything seemed to be wonderfully rich. In the late 1890s and early part of the 20th century, despite economic ups and downs, which America always has, they seemed to be absolutely immune from everything. There was all the money and all the thought of bringing our country on a par with England and France, and we were going to lead the world forward, and our banks would do it. And there was a wonderful banker called Charles Tracy Barney, who you see a lot about in the early 20th century, and he runs this Knickerbocker Bank, and they build these remarkable buildings that are meant to tell you your money's there forever. And in 1907, of course, there's the crisis when the Knickerbocker Bank goes down and Barney has to shoot himself. The trouble with the people of that era, including White, is they flew like Icarus too close to the sun and their wings melted and there was nothing left.
And then in other cases, banks like the Bowery Bank, which had they did a number of beautiful buildings.
Beautiful buildings, mainly by
they just were merged like so many others.
That's
and
right.
the big
Lost.
And maybe those big buildings were just too big to maintain.
They were. Those buildings in general are done later, although the original Bowery down at Grand Street is McKibben and White. The later Bowery savings banks were done by people in the office. And then people in the office who went on their own, who were York and Sawyer, who did the two big ones at 42nd Street and 73rd and Broadway. So in a way, those big banks, they were office buildings, and they're today, many of them converted into office blocks and apartments. I think 73rd Street and Broadway, that central savings there, the old Harlem Savings Bank, I think that's also apartments up there now.
They designed the Brooklyn Museum.
They sure did. It was done in the office. Almost by the time you're speaking of, where they're building clubs, entertaining people, looking for clients, they weren't doing the building. They had this is where Meade's role came in. Meade told them who was good in the office and who could lead a project. So it was other people in the office doing a lot of that.
But the Brooklyn Museum looks to me like it was modeled on the Metropolitan Museum
of Art. Yes, which had been Hunt. The original center core of the Fifth Avenue side of the Metropolitan Museum was Richard Morris Hunt, who then died. And I think as a gout-afflicted and the Dean of American Architecture at the time, and McKibben and White later got the side wings and the complex. They later did build at the Met, but the idea comes from Hunt. And then Brooklyn decides if the Metropolitan, our dear little museum, can exist in Manhattan, we've got to have a Brooklyn Academy of Arts and Science out on Eastern Parkway, and there they go.
How do you think McKibben and White would feel about the new front that was designed by James Stewart Polshek?
Well, I don't think they'd be very happy because it exposes the brick that was – when they built a wall with brick, they clad it in stone, and what they've done is remove the cladding. So it's like you're looking at somebody without their clothes on, and you're looking at their underwear, and you don't want to.
Now, the Morgan Library, which is also designed by them, was just redone. Do you think they'd be happier with that?
Yes, I think that was really done in spirit, where a great deal of money was spent not to make it attract people like the Louvre, but rather to build in what they had already, which was a great building.
Yeah, they were part of the City Beautiful movement,
yes,
weren't
they?
Was this something that they just subscribed to?
No, I think they truly believed, again, that it was their role to accomplish it. They knew the rich. They knew the powerful. They knew what Europe looked like. They knew what culture was supposed to be, even though none of them really studied art history or architectural history or any of this. But it was their mandate to make us as beautiful as Paris. Just what Edith Wharton was saying, you know, America is so straggling and ill-built, no fountains, no public buildings. And McKim would have piped up and said, right, we've got to help with this.
So they're working on Prospect Park on the one hand and Columbia University on the other,
and the
Lowe Memorial Library and John Jay Hall and some of the other buildings there.
True.
All just major architectural treasures of New York. And is there any – did they ever do a building in Chicago, the other great architecture city?
Oh, yes, but not very many. Because McKim was the second in command at the White City, as they called it, the World's Columbian Fair of 1893, he and Burnham put it together. Now, Burnham, the Chicago architect, was in charge of that fair, but McKim was his right-hand man. And McKim, that's where they came up with the idea of the American Academy, in front of a blazing log, as they lived in cabins, literally, out on the lakefront, trying to get the building together in a Chicago winter. They did do a few houses, the Brian Lathrop House, which is now a women's club in Chicago. There's a Patterson House, same family that they built a house for in Washington. They did a little bit more in Chicago, but not. Chicago was parochial to its own architects.
Since they didn't do a lot of skyscrapers.
Right.
Is their ideal the Palladian ideal?
No, I think they would have left towards the end. McKim became very old-fashioned. Oddly enough, he said he was one of the first people to ride on the elevated line when New York created the L's in the middle of the 1870s. But by 1906, he writes to Stanford White's son, whose mentoring he takes over when White is killed, and says he hates all these new tall buildings and all these modern – he really goes back to appreciating just the palace and the quiet of life. But Stanford White was dying. They did do some office buildings. They also entered competitions. The wonderful building that is now Borders at 100 Broadway, the American Surety Building that Bruce Price won the competition to do, they entered that and they lost. They lost a lot of competitions. They didn't really have it for building the office building as the clients wished it. So they didn't, but there's a couple of buildings on Beekman Street. They did modest office buildings. In fact, there's one still with us at 20th Street and Broadway. On the southeast corner is the Gillette Building for the Gillette Estate. Now doubled, but it's there. That's an office building by McKim and White. And there's several for the Vanderbilts on Beekman Street. They do exist, but it was not their métier.
And mostly they were New York-based, although they did stuff in New England.
They did Newport. Newport heavily, Lenox area.
Because that's where the rich were.
Well, you know what? I think if we said, speaking of class, they tended to build not for the old families of the region, not for the patrician, mercantile, merchants of the port class who were already established like an Edith Wharton, but rather for the people who had fairly new money.
Although Astor is an exception.
Well, but they don't majorly build. Astor's house architects were Clinton and Russell, who were another firm who did most of their work. He does that wonderful tennis court, and he does a ballroom at Beechwood, Mrs. Astor's house at Newport. But in general, they stuck to Clinton and Russell.
Well, they, by the way, should point out another favorite building of mine, and that is the Town Hall building on 43rd Street.
Oh, yes, that's a lovely building. Again, that's late, and the buildings in the book are those in which we know they had a great personal contact. Many of the buildings that are not in the book either were done after they were dead or by the office, or the buildings they didn't particularly take a role in.
But the office is important in an architectural firm.
Absolutely.
When we talk about Skidmore, Owens, and Merrill, we're talking about an environment, a sensibility. And in this case, McKim, Mead & White set the tone.
They sure did. I would also say that McKim, Mead & White is probably the first very large office in the United States, and probably second in the world. I would say George Gilbert Scott in England was a slightly earlier version of an office that did the same, 1,000 buildings.
How long did they last?
As themselves, as a firm. Do you know that firm is still with us?
McKim, Mead & White is still
no longer
there.
Called. After 1952, they changed the name.
Mosette Broderick will be reading from her book on Tuesday, January 11th at 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble store in Tribeca. That's at 96 Warren Street and Greenwich. The book, Triumvirate, McKim, Mead & White, published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for asking me, and an honor to be here.
On tomorrow's show, we'll look at the human cost of overseas drug tests and then New Yorker fiction editor Deborah Treisman and two of the writers who were featured in the 20 Under 40 issue that's now available in book form. Also, Phoebe Hoban on the unconventional life of the unconventional artist Alice Neal, and our resident language expert Patricia T. O'Connor will talk about the derivation of holiday words. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Christina Maldonado, Sasha von Olderhausen, Max Bass, and Carrie Barber. Jason Isaac was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow.